Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Death and taxes are the two sure things, they say. In the last week, the storm's been brewing on the tax front. Former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan reemerged to say he never meant to sanction all George Bush's big tax cuts and the GOP-led spending that rolled right on. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson told Congress the federal debt ceiling needs bumping over $9 trillion. New health care plans are talking higher taxes for the high income. War costs are nearing $3 billion a week. Up next, On Point, crunch time and the unspeakable, your taxes and the next president. Joining me today from Washington is William Gale. He's Vice President and Director of Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution. He was Senior Staff Economist for the Council of Economic Advisors from 91 to 92 under President George H.W. Bush. William Gale, welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire is Andrew Samwick. He was Chief Economist on George W. Bush's President's Council of Economic Advisors, 03 to 04, currently a professor of economics at Dartmouth College. Andrew Samwick, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be with you.
I wish you'd both just give us a snapshot. You follow taxes so deeply. You've been listening to Alan Greenspan in the last week sort of bemoan what happened between tax cuts and spending. Barack Obama rolling out some plans and talking about taxes last week. The debt ceiling going up again. Lots of tension this week over the budget. William Gale, let me come first to you. As a nation, after nearing the end of this administration of President George W. Bush, where do we stand when it comes to taxes?
Well, we're in an interesting situation because we have one of the few real deadlines in tax policy coming up, which is that at the end of 2010, all of the tax cuts, or almost all of the tax cuts that have been enacted since 2001, will expire all at the same time. And that has a way of focusing people's attention in terms of making changes. So it's both an opportunity to reform the system, and if we want to do that, we need to start the discussion now. And I think you're beginning to see the inklings of that in the campaign.
Andrew Samwick, if we come to 2010, and who knows, but if it should all snap back to what it was before George W. Bush, what would that change look like?
Well, for one, we'd close about a half of the current on-budget deficit, and that wouldn't be a bad thing. I don't think they would let it get that far. I think that as the moment arrives, someone or some group of people will step forward and pass some legislation that's a little more orderly than, okay, let's pretend it's 2001 again.
But what would it mean in terms of individual Americans? Who, remind us, whose taxes would go jolting back up if the Bush tax cuts were allowed to expire in 2010?
Well, of the ones that have not been made permanent so far, the most important are the higher marginal tax rates on the highest income taxpayers. But Bill's your expert on that, so maybe he has something to add.
Bill Gale, remind us, if the rubber band snaps back, what would that look like? Let's start with high-income Americans.
Well, they have both the rate cuts that Andrew mentioned, the dividend and capital gains reductions that were enacted in 2003, the estate tax reductions that were enacted in 2001. I don't think anyone's really talking about going back to the 2001 system. A lot of people say they want to repeal the tax cuts, but that's becoming an increasingly empty notion in that the tax cuts expire, you know, in 3 years anyway. The real question is, can we use this as an opportunity to move toward a more sensible tax system rather than just jacking rates up or jacking them down?
So what have we learned in these years of the Bush tax cuts? Alan Greenspan now expresses remorse. President Bush is a dyed-in-the-wool tax cutter. I mean, is there a big takeaway lesson here? Have these years with its deficits proven that you cannot cut taxes like that and keep everything on an even keel, Andrew Samwick? Or has the economic growth that we've seen for many of these years tended to bear out George Bush's view of the world?
Oh, I don't think anything over the last several years bears out the particular version of George Bush's view of the world, which is it seems to be that lower taxes are always and everywhere a good idea. The government raises revenue for two general reasons. The first is to pay for government expenses, its purchases of goods and services. The second is to redistribute income, whether by income level, age, or health or disability status. Okay, so we can have a discussion of whether and how much of these things we should do, but it should be a precondition to that discussion that whatever we decide to do, we're going to pay for it. So what happened over the course of the last 6 years was a decision to tax current generations to a lesser degree without corresponding reductions in the extent to which these generations were benefiting from government services.
And you
okay, that's not going to prove anything.
You were, I mean, you say that having been chief economist on the President's Council of Economic Advisors, was he taking your advice or not?
Oh, I should always, as I am when I announce it, it was a staff position. So I wasn't one of the three presidential appointees. When I had gotten there in the middle of 2003, the last rounds of tax cuts from 2003 had gone through, and the Medicare bill was in conference already. That was basically the end of the tax cutting energy of the Bush administration. When you go and you work for a president's administration, you do the very best you can. At the time, you know, we were still kind of looking backwards to a recession that was apparent from early 2001. We thought it was pretty good timing that there were tax cuts in place. Doesn't mean they were optimally designed to address slipping into recession. The labor market hadn't yet bottomed out, and so we were very cautious at the time. It's what you do in the healthy part of the business cycle that really determines what your budget policy is. When you run a deficit during the lean times, do you pay it back during the healthy times? There's been no indication from anybody who's a Republican, whether in the administration or serving in official office outside of it, that that's what they intend to do. Well, that expresses the frustration that I think Republicans like me would have about what's happened over the last 6 years.
We'll look at where the candidates may be going. Bill Gale, you've got a book coming out called Taxing the Future. What's your bottom line assessment of taxes and tax policy in the age of George W. Bush?
Well, as you can tell from the title, it's very similar to what Andrew just said, that we cut taxes now without cutting spending, in fact, with increasing spending. And if you do that, it's not really a tax cut. It's a postponement of taxes. It's actually an increase in taxes on future generations. So the combined policy of raising spending now and lowering taxes now is, by definition, a policy that involves increasing taxes in the future and or cutting spending in the future.
And in your assessment, is that future going to show up in the 4 years of the next president?
Well, some of it will. I mean, all of these things, these intergenerational obligations that are passed from one generation to the next, they take time and they're to manifest themselves. And so a colleague of mine describes them as termites in the woodwork, not the wolf at the door. So it's not an immediate crisis, although it could fuel immediate crises. But in terms of that, that's not enough to make a good policy. We don't think that it's generally a good idea to be eating away at the foundation or the seed corn or whatever analogy you want to use going
Anderson.
Forward.
Mm.
Sorry. So what Andrew was saying is if you're consistently, if you're always running deficits, even in good times, you're basically eating away at the nation's saving and its ability to invest in the future.
Andrew Samwick, when Ronald Reagan was elected, marginal tax rates, and it's hard to believe or remember now, marginal tax rates in this country at the high end were 70%. Ronald Reagan cut the top rate to 28%. It's never been back up above 40% since then and considerably below that now. Do you see the top end, the high end of American
tax rates for upper-income earners headed back up necessarily, and how high, if they are?
Well, I'll take the first part of it. It was 70%, but it was with plenty of loopholes. Mm. When it was 28%, there were substantially fewer loopholes that were left. And so the effective tax rates at 70% as a statutory rate were actually a fair bit lower.
Okay, fair.
What happened during the Reagan administration was the result of a multi-year, largely bipartisan effort to talk about tax reform that began with blueprints being drawn up even in the late 70s. That's not what we have today. I have a feeling that there will be no political constituency available between the executive and the legislative branches to prevent the tax cuts from going up. That'll be the starting point for our negotiations. So they will go up. It's just a question of how much.
How much and for whom? Is it certain that that means higher taxes for the high end, Professor Samwick, or is everybody in line for a bigger tax hit here?
Well, I think everybody is eligible, but there doesn't seem to be a pressing policy imperative to balance the budget. As long as there's no imperative to do that, then the idea that politicians would think they could make any progress by increasing taxes on working class and middle class families without substantially increasing them on higher income folks, just not a possibility.
We're joined from Washington right now by John Harwood, a chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and senior contributing writer for The Wall Street Journal. John Harwood, it's been a while. Good to hear from you.
Hey, Tom.
John, give us a sense of where the tax issue stands out on the hustings. Are the candidates getting their hands around this one or leaving it in the shadows?
Well, Republicans are sticking very consistently with the Bush line. They think this is, after so many of the issues that have divided the Republican Party, they think this is one that unites Republicans. Democrats have gingerly gone out and made the case that now is the time to change the distribution of the tax burden and to raise taxes for some other priorities like health care. So they're talking about raising taxes on hedge fund managers. They're talking about raising taxes on people who make over, say, $250,000 a year. And the polls suggest that those are fairly popular steps, but Democrats retain some nervousness about the tax issue is something that when they get to a general election, they've got to handle very carefully so that they don't revive old memories of Democrats as the tax and spend party.
Barack Obama came out last week with a big tax plan unveiled. It kind of got lost in the news of the week. What is Senator Obama suggesting, John?
Well, Obama is talking about a very large redistribution of the tax burden. Controversial, even within his own party. Some of the Democratic economists that I talk to think it doesn't make a lot of sense, some of the priorities that he outlined. But nevertheless, he's trying to campaign as somebody who wants to define himself as a tax cutter. He would relieve all income taxes for senior citizens who make under $50,000 a year. Senior citizens, I would point out, voted very high rates. He would give every homeowner who does not itemize his or her tax deductions a new $500 credit designed to give them some benefit from paying mortgage interest, which people who itemize, of course, get and claim on their taxes. And he'd also give a new $500 per person credit against the payroll tax for every American. And his economists say that that will benefit 95% of American households, about 150 million of them. And the question that's going to be raised by his opponents is whether he can pay for that tax cut through what he would do at the upper end of the scale and whether it's wise to do so.
Has he laid out what he would do at the upper end of the scale? Who would pay for all that?
Not specifically. He says he will raise capital gains and dividend rates by at least to 20%, which was the rate before the Bush cuts early in 2001, 2002.
Which took it to 15.
Perhaps up to the old Reagan level of 28%. And he says that he would restore the previous top rate. I think it was 39.6 for people at the top end of the scale. That was the rate that Bill Clinton bequeathed to George Bush.
And what about Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, as part of their health care reform? They want to reverse Bush's tax cuts on Americans, in Clinton's case, with incomes above $250,000, in Edwards' case, with incomes above $200,000. How high would those taxes go if those cuts are reversed?
Well, I think those are also talking about going up to the 39.6 level. And one thing I left out in Obama's plan,
yes,
he would need a lot of money from rolling back what he calls corporate loopholes, offshore tax havens, other advantages that major corporations take in the code. But he didn't itemize which ones that he's talking about. So that's there's a big question mark surrounding that. And, of course, one of the problems here is that sometimes you get the feeling that these Democrats have spent these upper income tax increases about five different times, whether it's for deficit reduction or whether it's for health care or other priorities. And one of the challenges that they're going to face in the campaign is making it all add up. And, of course, we saw President Bush out here saying about the Democrats in Congress trying to revive his popularity by slapping around the Congress, saying they want to raise spending so they can raise your taxes, and he's going to play that card.
Of course, spending has already been awfully healthy for a lot of Bush years. Let's begin to go to our callers, if I may. Helen's calling from Bettendorf, Iowa. Hi, Helen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. As a mother of five, I want to talk about the future here and what I consider the nonstop pandering that we have to the elderly in terms of, you know, the taxes that my children will be expected to pay in the future in order to fund what is basically unfettered access to Medicare, and how we're going to continue with the baby boomers, 76 million of them beginning to retire. How are we going to pay for that without putting an outrageous burden on our children? I mean, I really look at it as an issue of morality here.
So you're saying it's not about taxes, it's about entitlements? Let the old folks make do however they can. You keep taxes where they were, or would you raise them, Helen?
I want to say that I'm actually a geriatric social worker, so I come from that background, but I look at just the inequity in it. And I would say that we are going to have to do one of two things, either raise taxes and cut benefits. We can't continue to just increase benefits without the idea that the tax, it's going to be raised from somewhere, and it's going to come from the future generations. And that, to me, is just completely not only unfair but immoral.
Helen, thanks very much. William Gale, your forthcoming book is Taxing the Future. So in what the Democrats are talking about so far, do you hear an answer to the kind of concerns Helen is raising? Is it a choice of what gets cut, you know, entitlements or taxes going up?
This isn't a Democrat or Republican issue. This isn't the campaign versus the governing issue. This is everybody, I think, is looking at the issue too narrowly, and the caller put your finger on it. I mean, on the tax side, we've got the expiring provisions. We've got the AMT growing out of control. On the spending side, we've got what economists call entitlements, but what Helen referred to accurately is Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
We've got defense spending growing. On the environmental side, we've got global warming, the potential to discuss a carbon tax or some alternatives. I think what we're going to see is not just a tax policy or a spending cut, but an effort to sit down people from all sides and say, in 2009, and say, okay, look, we're all in this mess. Let's forget about how we got here. Let's figure out how to get out of it. And I could see several of these issues being solved in a joint manner, both because they need to substantively, but also politically. If you're going to say that you need to raise taxes, you want to link that to something else, either new spending that the taxes are going to finance, so like a tax that financed health care for people who needed it, or you need to show that you're not just picking on one group and raising their taxes, you're tightening your belt all the way across and you're cutting some spending too. But I think Helen's comments lead directly to the notion that what we need is a big fix, that these things can't get fixed one thing at a time.
We'll look at what that big fix might be, but Andrew Samwick, let me ask you. You're a kind of a conservative and an economist. You know the Republican Party. We recently saw Ramesh Ponnaroo, conservative writer for the National Review, saying the Republicans are making a big mistake if they don't own tax cuts as an issue. Yet there's Alan Greenspan, Republican, saying, you know, this has gotten out of hand. Do you sense an appetite coming in the Republican Party, Andrew Samwick, to sit down for a kind of major overhaul, something beyond the formula of tax cuts and vote for me?
Sadly, I don't. I don't see anyone on the Republican side who doesn't start with either of two premises. First, that the first thing you have to do is make these tax cuts permanent, or notions about some fair tax plan, which becomes a Republican theme periodically as they propose switching the base from income more to consumption. I think Helen's call is excellent. She is right. If you're a traditional Republican like I thought I was, you'll look at what we're going to do to our children's generation mm-hmm. and their tax burdens, and you will think of it as an issue of morality. So she's right. There's no will on the Republican side to not own the issue of tax cuts, but own the idea that a government shouldn't spend the next generation's money.
John Harwood, what about the Republican contenders for the presidential nomination? If you look at Giuliani, if you look at Romney, McCain, and right on down, what do you see on the campaign trail being said here?
Well, so far, it's mostly free lunch stuff. They're not talking about cutting benefits. They're talking about cutting taxes. Giuliani's solution for health care is to cut taxes for the purchase of individual insurance, for example, with the idea that this will lower health prices and by generating a competition. However, there is one wild card on the Republican field. That's Fred Thompson, who hasn't filled in the blanks, and he's dropped some hints that he might be up for a little straight talk on entitlement programs. And there's no doubt about it. A big fix is going to be needed to solve that problem. That's the real fiscal crisis. It's not year-to-year discretionary spending or even military spending. It's the long-term cost of baby boom retirements and Social Security and Medicare. If Fred Thompson comes out with some bracing talk, that's an unusual political strategy. Politicians usually don't do that in a campaign, but maybe this is an unusual year that in which that will happen.
Of course, that would be looking at the spending side, not the taxing side, but in the end, they're all bound up together. Let's take a call from North.
Taxing side as well, though, not just talking about potentially cutting benefits, but also lifting the cap on Social Security taxation, which is one step toward a solution, potentially.
People pitching in more as they go up the income ladder. Let's go to Steve in North Augusta, South Carolina. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you know?
Great show. The Economist. I've never heard economists speak with such clarity. And my question has to do with my frustration in the political side of it, where the politicians on both sides, Republicans, Democrats, play the what I call the middle class card. They promise to cut taxes for the middle class, and then we need to tax the rich more. And then, interestingly enough, neither side ever defines the middle class. And I think most voters walk around and say, "Oh man, he's going to cut my taxes," because I think 90% of us think we're in the middle class. And we've defined poverty. There's a federal level of poverty. Is there something the economists can shed some clarity on that? And they speak so well, both of them. I just love the clarity, especially coming from the dismal science.
Steve, let us pick it up. William Gale, can we define, can we nail down middle class so Steve and others can follow the bouncing ball about who's really paying what?
The middle class is anyone that makes about as much money as you do. In Northern Virginia, where I live, there are families making $150,000, $200,000 who think of themselves as middle class, whereas any kind of income distribution you looked at in the country, they'd be in the top 5%. I think the caller is right. I mean, everyone sort of defines themselves as middle class now, with a few exceptions at the top, and maybe 15% at the bottom, and so it's very there is no standard definition, and so I think that the notion that politicians
so there's a median income level, and it's not $150,000.
No, that's correct. There is a median income level. It escapes me at the moment. I would guess it's around 50,000-60,000
household, right around 50, I think.
Four. Mm-hmm. But again, that amount of money in Iowa is going to be quite different than that in terms of the living standard than that amount of money in New York City or Los Angeles. Mm. And so it's very difficult to to define, you know, exactly what the middle class means, or more accurately, my definition might be different from someone else's. And he's right. The politicians use that expression precisely because everyone thinks it's them.
I have to say here, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Andrew Samwick, how about yourself? You know, Jonathan Chait at the New Republic is out with his a big new book called The Big Con. He says, really, all these tax cuts in the last in the Bush years were all about helping the high end, the wealthy. They were just packaged as middle class tax cuts. Our caller says, well, who is that middle class? How do you define it?
Well, I try not to, for the exact reason that has us preoccupied with this issue. It's a vague term, and you know that vagueness allows politicians to exploit it. I think that we would have a healthier dialogue if we talked about a very few limited number of tax credits for people at the low end of the income distribution, and low is going to have different meanings as well. And then everything was talked about only in terms of proportional shifts up and down. You know, those sorts of conversations, I think, would go a little bit easier than the ones we're currently having.
John Harwood, what about the political conversation around this now? Are Democrats railing on the Bush cut taxes for the rich and not for you theme, or are they trying to please all parties?
No, they're definitely hitting that theme, and they're doing it more commonly in the name of the middle class, because they believe that's a more politically popular formulation. John Edwards, notably in the campaign, has tried to frame his rhetoric more aggressively in terms of trying to help the poor, making the argument that this is not a popular strategy, which in a general election it isn't, although it's not. There's no particular reason to think it's unpopular in a Democratic primary. And so, yes, indeed, there Democrats are saying that the Bush Republican Party have had their priorities wrong, that they have conned you about fiscal responsibility and who they're helping, and it's time to fix it.
And the tax cut theme, does that still play with the GOP base? Ramesh Ponnerau says it's that or you're in trouble, Republicans. Do you think he's got that right, John?
I think all the Republican political strategists I know believe that. None of the Republican candidates, including John McCain, who voted against the Bush tax cuts, is talking about letting them expire. They're all talking about permanency of the Bush tax cuts. Nobody's talking about raising rates on capital gains and dividends. None of the Republican candidates have come out in favor of raising taxes on private equity executives, even though people like Bob Rubin and Warren Buffett have said that that's justified by the fact that people are getting capital gains breaks for what ought to be counted as ordinary income. So there is no sign yet that with all the other problems Republicans are having, that they're willing to tempt fate by abandoning the tax cut issue.
Pete is calling from Narragansett, Rhode Island. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes. I think that, again, the issue is being obfuscated. The Congress is getting ready to vote to increase the national debt to something like $9-point-something trillion.
Yes, indeed.
And how can you say that the tax cuts for the rich have worked if you're having to increase the debt to that level? Bush is complaining about spending $35 billion for children's health insurance, and yet he has no compulsion at all about a compunction about squandering that money in a couple of months in Iraq. I think Congress ought to stand up and just say, hey, wait a minute, we're the ones that control the money. And why are you, you know, why are you opposing tax cuts, or why are you opposing tax increases when we are already being snowed by debt that is caused not by entitlement programs? They're still paying for themselves, but we're looting those entitlement programs in order to pay for this war and to pay for the other stuff. It's all voodoo economics in the Office of Budget and Management there.
Pete, let us pick it up. Andrew Samwick, how do you respond?
Well, there's a couple of points where we jump off of Pete's comments. The first is he's right about looting entitlements. And you asked me earlier if there was a lesson from the last couple of years that we might take away from this. I'm set up for it now. So we've learned from a president who wanted to cut taxes, cut taxes, cut taxes, and at the same time try to do something to bring Social Security into long-term balance, that it is impossible for people to take you seriously about the issues you identify as important if you treat the general fund deficits as if they don't matter. We learned that, and I think Pete's call points out the frustration that that's imposing on people as they try to sift through all the political rhetoric.
But who's the we when you say we learned that? The Republican Party, economists, conservative economists like yourself, who's we having learned that?
Well, I suspect Bill already knew it in 2001, but maybe I'm the one who learned it here. But, you know, you get an opportunity to learn these things as they happen.
Has Rudy Giuliani taken that lesson away? Has Mitt Romney taken that lesson away? For that matter, Hillary Clinton?
None of it is reflected in the public statements of any of the candidates that you've mentioned. You know, Barack Obama, bless his heart, is trying to distinguish himself from other prominent, close-to-the-front candidates. He's coming out with actual specifics. So I don't know if they've learned that lesson. They're not saying enough about it if they have.
Let's go to Frank in Walcott, Connecticut. Frank, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm a former IRS employee and part of a task force that was set up a number of years ago before I retired. And we figured that in order to deal properly and fully with the tax system, since only 47% of people really pay their taxes at the time that we did the study, a value-added tax, a flat tax to replace the income tax, a export excise tax, and an import excise tax.
So you say don't mess around at the margins and the marginal rates, but get in more fundamentally to reform
exactly.
Here.
The tax code is too complicated. It's made for capital investment. The fact is that we realized at the time that the trickle-down economy theory wouldn't last that long, and that money would eventually go overseas as opposed to staying in the United States and cause all kinds of problems, and that the actual delinquency rate of non-filers and underreported income and non-reported income would increase over the decades.
John Harwood, we'll ask about the politics of that more fundamental reform, but Bill Gale, this gets right into your wheelhouse. Frank was with the IRS and is talking about some major reforms there. You talk a lot about major reforms. If we really keelhauled this thing and tried to get it right, you say the system we have now is complex and unfair. Where would you begin to look to fundamentally change it if that's what's required?
Well, there's sort of two approaches. One is, do you throw the whole system out and start over with some other system? And the other is, do you try to fix the system that we've got? And you can convince yourself that either of them is too complicated and too hard to pursue. My own approach is not to let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and hence to aim to try to fix the current system to the broadest extent possible. Now, we've done that in different ways in the past. The key, as we were talking about earlier, is eliminating loopholes and lowering rates. And at the same time, that would have the effect of simplifying the tax system. Now, when you talk about simplifying the tax system, everyone is in favor of it. It's the one thing in tax policy that everyone is in favor of. And yet every year the system gets more complicated, which gives you a sense of how distorted the politics of tax reform actually are.
You're saying don't just go straight to flat tax. It's not that simple. You would keep a progressive graduated taxation, but add into that a kind of value-added tax so that people are paying as products get purchased or move through the economy?
The issues about flat taxes versus progressive rates pale compared to the issues of what it is you're taxing in the first place, the income versus consumption or carbon emissions or something else. And a value-added tax is essentially a consumption tax. And one of the great issues we will need to confront is if we need to raise revenues, if we keep spending the way it is projected to be, we're going to need to raise revenues. And then we ask ourselves, do we want to introduce a new tax like a value-added tax or an energy tax, or do we want to burden the existing taxes more? I think if we think about that carefully, we'll do what other countries have done, which is create a value-added tax.
and do away with the income tax? Ultimately?
No, what most European countries have is an income tax and a value-added tax. If you want to get the revenues to pay for the spending that people appear to want, you may not have any options other than to have both taxes going.
All right, John Harwood, this requires stepping way back. I mean, you don't hear too much about that on the campaign trail, but we are facing a future which has got great big icebergs sitting in it. What do you make of the country's political temperature here, John, the readiness for something more fundamental and how that may or may not get discussed in this presidential campaign season?
I think it is appealing in theory, but not very appealing in practice, which is why most of the politicians are well where Bill Gale is. The only major candidate right now who is daring to talk about a fundamental reform of the system, that is to throw out the income tax code and replace it with something else, is Mike Huckabee of Arkansas, the Republican candidate, the perhaps the most populist Republican candidate. He's talking about the so-called fair tax. It would be a national sales tax of around 23%. Junk the income tax code. There are some theoretical merits to this. That is, you'd be taxing consumption and not savings and investment. One of the questions about a tax reform of that kind is, can you make it progressive? Because progressivity, that is taxing the people who have more at higher rates than those who have less, retains some measure of popularity politically in the country. Even Mitt Romney, who I talked to about this, who said we're not ready for the fair tax right now, acknowledges that, even as he's calling for preserving the Bush tax cuts. But there's no sign right now that anybody thinks that the politics favor talking about a radical reform of the system.
And looking at what's coming down the road, do you think the GOP, whoever their nominee is, can ultimately carry the tax cut torch? As Ramesh Ponnuru says, that's the way for a Republican to win? Or does it look like Americans have become wary about that, as Andrew Samwick has, even among Republicans?
Well, I think the sign of how wary they are is going to come in who wins the election.
Mm-hmm.
If a Republican wins the election, he will undoubtedly be running on a campaign, because they all are right now, of cutting taxes. But one of the reasons why Republicans are in the soup right now, it's not just Iraq, and not just the corruption issue, which we've talked about, but also some feeling that they haven't delivered, and certainly discontent among moderates and some conservatives with their fiscal record is part of that.
John Harwood, senior Chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. Good to have you again, John. I know we have to let you go. Thanks very much for being here today.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Let's take a call from Waltham, Massachusetts. Colby, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having my call.
Sure.
Hey, I just wanted to put this to your guest. One of your guests just said that Mike Huckabee was the only candidate that's suggesting removing the income tax, but that's absolutely not true. If Mike Huckabee is considered a major candidate, then I would suggest that Ron Paul is on the same level as Mike Huckabee. Ron Paul has called for a complete reform of the system, we have a system based on the Federal Reserve, a private bank that issues us our currency at interest, and basically the income tax pays off that interest. So if we have a complete reform of the system, getting rid of the income tax for a system that we don't even need, we can think of alternative ways to pay for the services and entitlements that, in a way, Ron Paul isn't even in favor of that on a federal level.
It sounds like you're for that. Let's get our economists to respond.
Right.
Andrew Samwick, here we've got support for Mike Huckabee and his fair tax, for Ron Paul and tossing out the income tax. As an economist, how do you look at these proposals, this national sales tax in effect from Huckabee first?
Well, I'll say a couple of things. Colby is right. I don't agree with what John said about who's in favor of the fair tax. If you go to the fairtax.org website, more than just Mike Huckabee are listed as either proponents of it or willing to do it. You don't see it from Giuliani, McCain, or Romney.
Would it work? 23% national sales tax in effect on retail purchases? Could we do that and get rid of the income tax and everything's hunky-dory?
Tom, this is Bill Gale. Can I jump in on this?
Yeah, yeah.
There's been a debate going on for a decade about this, about whether the 23% rate is actually the right rate.
Some say 28 or 29 is what we're really talking about.
Well, the Joint Tax Committee says you need a rate well into the 30s. The
okay.
President's Commission on Tax Reform says you'd need a rate well into the 30s, and these rates are calculated in ways that a 30
say a 33% sales tax, the way these things are calculated, is really a 50% markup at the register. So if an item costs a dollar and there's a 50-cent tax placed on it, most of us would call that a 50% sales tax.
Okay, what about
sales,
that then?
Sales tax people call that a 33%.
We'll just go with your get real analysis then and call it a 50% markup.
Yeah, so first thing is when people think about the sales tax, they need to realize the rate that's being discussed is very misleading, and independent government agencies have come up with much higher rates. I have myself as well. The other thing is no country or jurisdiction in the history of the world has been able to enforce a sales tax with rates much above 10 or 12%.
Why? What happens?
And the reason is it's a very easy tax to evade. There's only one point of connection. And with the tax, there's only one transaction that's taxed, and the person who owes the tax is also the one who records the transaction.
But the state sales tax seems to be collected pretty effectively.
No, the state sales taxes are a disaster, and they're around 4 to 6%.
Right. So if we jack it up to 50% markup, you're going to have everything sold out of the back of trucks in a back alley to avoid it?
Let me finish. State sales tax don't tax a whole lot of things that you'd have to tax under a national sales tax, like health care and food and housing. And people say, oh, we'll exempt that. Well, that's half of all consumption. And the state sales tax would get away with a lot precisely because they're not trying to raise much revenue. A national retail sales tax would have to tax these things that people tend not to want to tax. They'd have to tax at a very high rate, and it'd be very difficult to enforce. So it's not a coincidence that literally no country in the world has a sales tax above the 10 to 12%.
Andrew Samwick, are you equally skeptical about this fair tax, kind of national sales tax, and a whopping one at that as an option?
Yeah, equally skeptical, a lot less eloquent about it. I would just recommend Bruce Bartlett has been the one taking up the call this time around to try to put some clarity on what the fair tax proposal would do.
The numbers, and they're high numbers. So here we are. I mean, we've got a problem sitting in front of us. Everything I'm hearing described here says nobody is fully at grips with it. Andrew Samwick, if you could put a presidential policy in effect for the next president, whoever that might be, what would the broad outlines of it look like?
Okay, well, the first thing is that we would spend a lot of time talking about the need to match the level of revenues collected to the level of expenses that are paid out. We would talk about that almost to the exclusion of questions about how we raise the revenue. That's the first thing.
Control spending.
Mm-hmm. Well, just match the revenues to the expenditures. That should be the first principle. Let's see. So I should be more specific about ways I would boost that revenue. Well, the first thing I would do actually is on the spending side. This is my Republican roots. I would take, I'll call it 10% out of all discretionary outlays, which includes defense. That's 10% of a number that's about $1 trillion. So that'd be about $100 billion that we get. The next item I'd do is I would look for all places where we deviate from the principle that income should be taxed. So this is really what generates the complexity in the income tax. It's all these special treatment of this type of income or exclusion of income if it's used for that purpose. Mm-hmm. I would look to pare almost all of them back, and that includes deductions for state and local taxes. It includes the exclusion of health insurance premiums from taxable income. It includes the mortgage interest deduction for at least the very highest value homes and the like. That's where you start.
Goodbye to all that. Pay as you go, Alan Greenspan likes to call it, and tax everything in sight without loopholes. There's clearly a lot more on that list, and Bill Gale, I know you have yours as well. We'll have to get to it another day, but it's been a great snapshot of where things stand, and I'm very grateful to each of you. Andrew Samwick at Dartmouth College, thanks a lot for joining us in this hour. And William Gale at the Brookings Institution, Taxing the Future, his book coming out. Bill Gale, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.